rushes to judgment are a big cause of wrongful convictions, and that if we took a little bit more time at the trial level to investigate and make sure that we're not charging first and investigating later, then we wouldn't have as many wrongful convictions.
Welcome to Partners in Justice, a podcast from the Center for American and International Law. We deliver in-depth discussions about the rule of law and improving the quality of justice with leaders and experts from the legal and law enforcement communities.
Hello, and welcome to the Partners in Justice podcast, hosted by the Center for American and International Law. I'm Vicki Adams, Director of Special Programs here at CAIL. My guest on the podcast today is Naomi Howard. Naomi is a constitutional defense attorney in Texas. Her practice focuses on investigations and criminal defense matters in Texas and federal courts. She is also a board member of the Texas Innocence Project. Naomi, thank you for being here today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the type of work that you do and your tie to the Texas Innocence Project?
Well, thank you for having me, Vicki. This is exciting, celebrating CAIL's 75th anniversary and being part of this program. My start in constitutional defense was in Waco, Texas, where I grew up, and there's 26% poverty rate in Waco, and that is a lot. And so I would see the disparity that people without financial and educational and familial resources experience in the legal system, the criminal justice system specifically. And that led me to law school at St. Mary's and focusing on criminal and constitutional defense. I don't like to call it criminal defense because I'm defending people's rights according to the Constitution and state law. So that's why I'd like to reframe how we consider lawyers who are helping to assert people's rights in the criminal justice system. But I, straight out of law school, I went to clerk at the Court of Criminal Appeals for Judge Burt Richardson. And it deepened my commitment to criminal justice. And I got a lot of work on writs of habeas corpus, petitions for discretionary review, and even the death penalty. So after that, I was in Houston and I continued as a private constitutional defense attorney at a firm there. And that's when I got started with the Innocence Project of Texas. So I've been with them since 2018 as a board member. And I've just really enjoyed working with the Innocence Project of Texas because you get to see wrongful convictions being overturned and the joy of not only the people who are wrongly incarcerated, but also their families. And I think that's something that gets lost. Incarceration doesn't affect just the person who's been convicted. It affects an entire family, and the repercussions of that affect our communities. So working with the Innocence Project of Texas, I am not involved in the litigation that they do directly. I have been local counsel, which is when you have the Innocence Project national involved, and people don't understand that the Innocence Project and Innocence Project of Texas are separate, that we're funded completely independently. So if you'd like to make a donation, make sure it goes to the Innocence Project of Texas. But we are under the umbrella of the Innocence Project, which is headquartered in New York. And so sometimes I'll be asked to be local counsel for one of their wrongful convictions that they took on, or I will be asked to assist in some way with one of our Innocence Project of Texas cases. But they have staff attorneys, and they are led very capably by Mike Ware, the executive director, and the deputy director, Allison Clayton, and they do great work. Yeah, so I help with the litigation committees, filing amicus briefs, sometimes, and hopefully developing legislative policy and, of course, fundraising.
And that's great. I didn't know all those aspects of your role. So it was fun to learn that. So today, Naomi and I will be talking about wrongful convictions and actual innocence. And we'll be doing that by taking a look at a case that's been in the news recently in Texas, the Melissa Lucio case. I want to start out by saying that Ms. Lucio has not had her conviction overturned at this point, but her case is a really interesting illustration of many common issues that arise in wrongful convictions. And we wanted to use this case as a way to illustrate those common issues. Kale has worked with grants from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals since around 2006 to educate lawyers, law enforcement, and judges on wrongful convictions, how they occur, how to avoid them in the future, and how to help identify and fix them. Additionally, we have a series of videos available on our YouTube channel for the public on the history of the innocence movement, common causes of wrongful convictions, and what law enforcement and lawyers are doing to make sure that in the future, innocent people aren't convicted of crimes that they didn't commit. So with that introduction, Naomi, why don't you give us a quick overview of the Melissa Lucio case?
Melissa Lucio's case is a case of an accident that was characterized as a murder. And Melissa Lucio, in 2007, she had 12 children and she was pregnant with twins. As she was moving her family into a new apartment, the apartment had external stairs, a stairway outside the apartment that led up to the apartment itself. And Mariah, because, you know, she's two, but also because she had underlying medical conditions, made her more prone to falling. And Mariah did fall, and she did not appear to have any life-threatening injuries. And so she was not taken to the hospital right away. And then 2 days later, after Melissa put her, Mariah, that is, to sleep on the bed, when Melissa came back to wake Mariah up, Mariah didn't wake up, and she had died. And Melissa, within 2 hours of the police being called and the investigation begun, police zeroed in on Melissa and didn't believe that it was an accident. They believed that Melissa had caused Mariah to fall down the stairs and had been abusing Mariah. Melissa's partner, Robert Alvarez, even though he had a long history of domestic abuse, was not accused of murder, and he was only convicted of endangerment to a child, got 4 years. But Melissa, on the other hand, after 5 hours of interrogation by the police, she, being so tired and being herself the victim of domestic abuse and thus susceptible to the questioning of law enforcement, especially law enforcement that was suggesting that she was the cause of her daughter's death, Melissa finally just said, "I guess I did it." And so really the false statement by Melissa during that 5-hour police interrogation, as well as the medical examiner's belief, and it's a false belief, that the injuries that Mariah suffered that led to her death could only have been caused by abuse, totally ignoring the fact that there could be other causes for Mariah's injuries, such as an accident and falling down the stairs. And so when Mariah went to trial, she was prosecuted by a district attorney that we now know is corrupt and is sitting in federal prison because of that corruption. And the judge during that trial wouldn't allow testimony that would be mitigation, that would show that Melissa was the victim of abuse and that this was a horrible, horrible accident. So the jury convicted her of murder, and then they moved on to the second phase of the criminal trial, which is punishment. And because mitigation evidence was not allowed in by the judge, for example, the domestic abuse, the rapes that she suffered as a child, 6 years old, because that information, that testimony was not allowed by the judge, and because the defense attorney didn't complete the mitigation investigation. All of that led the jury to believe that Melissa Lucio deserved death. So she was sitting on death row, and there was an appellate process in which you only direct appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals. There's an intermediate court, but death penalty cases are different. Only the Court of Criminal Appeals can review them. And Melissa got no relief. But the Innocence Project, based in New York, they started to get involved in, you know, only 100 days before Melissa was supposed to be executed. And they were able, by presenting the Court of Criminal Appeals with a writ of habeas corpus application, evidence that there are experts who believe that Melissa did not state that she killed Mariah, that it was a false statement coerced by law enforcement. And there were medical experts who said that the medical testimony given during Melissa's trial was also very flawed, and there were other explanations for the injuries that Mariah suffered. So there is both a writ of habeas corpus that is pending in the Court of Criminal Appeals, but then also the Innocence Project, in conjunction with that writ of habeas, has filed a petition for clemency with Governor Greg Abbott and the Texas Board of Parole, and no decision has been given by either the governor's office or the Board of Paroles. So the Court of Criminal Appeals granted a very last minute stay of execution, I think the day before she was supposed to be executed in April of this year. And the effect of that stay was that the Court of Criminal Appeals believed that that evidence presented at trial did need to be reexamined. So that means that Melissa's case has gone back down to the trial court for an evidentiary hearing to further develop those issues. And so that's procedurally where we are. That's, in a nutshell, what happened in Melissa Lucio's case. And so we're hoping for clemency or reversal of the trial court.
So there were a lot of things going on in that explanation, going on in that case. It's clear that it's not cut and dry. It wasn't an easy case in any way. You talked a little bit about the false confession. And I've heard some people say that confession is actually a little strong for the words that she used and the way all of that went down. Can you talk a little bit about Ms. Lucio's statement to law enforcement and talk a little bit about the reliability issues around that statement?
I'm glad that you mentioned false confession is a little bit misnomer. False confession, I think, is mainly used, much like criminal defense attorneys, you know, or the name of the attorneys like myself who defend people in the criminal justice system. It's a shorthand. And so people understand at what level this statement is being made. But I agree with you that false confession is not quite right. It's more like false agreement, and it's false agreement with what law enforcement asked Melissa during her 5-hour interrogation, because the questions were leading, and what a leading question is that it's mainly a yes or no question, and you present your version of the story and just ask the subject to agree with it. And the statements that Melissa made were very much those agreement statements. She was tired, and she basically agreed to whatever the law enforcement officers had told her to say. And Melissa said things like, "I guess I did it." She didn't positively say, "I killed my daughter. I pushed my daughter. I abused my daughter." She said nothing like that. She ambiguously said things like, "I guess I did it." Things like nodding or weak yes or no. And some of the factors that go into the susceptibility of Melissa in particular, her susceptibility to giving that kind of statement in which she just gives up at the end of 5 hours and said, I guess I did it. Those conditions that might make her more susceptible are her long history of physical and sexual abuse. Melissa was raped when she was 6 years old. And then again, when she was a teenager, her first marriage, she was basically a child bride, married when she was just a teenager. And the abuse, physical and sexual, continued. She managed to leave that marriage only to marry a second man, and he also physically and sexually abused her. And that kind of abuse makes a person who is the subject of an interrogation very vulnerable, especially when law enforcement, which in this case were male and were aggressive, they can trigger by their questioning and by their appearance the subject and bring back all of the trauma that that person experienced, especially when it goes as deep as it did for Melissa. Melissa also has very little education, some issues of IQ. So that also makes her very susceptible to giving a false statement. She was also pregnant with twins, and anyone would be exhausted after 5 hours of interrogation. But certainly someone who is pregnant with twins is going to be more susceptible because they have hormonal and physical things going on with them that, as you can imagine, would make them want to get out of that interrogation room, even if it means admitting or ambiguously stating that maybe you did it. Those are some of the reasons that Melissa was more susceptible to giving a false statement. And the Innocence Project has hired or has engaged two experts in false confession to examine the recordings as well as the statements. And they have definitively said that this was a quote-unquote false confession, and that Melissa did not admit to killing Mariah.
So one of the things that I thought was really interesting on that entire experience was that evidence of Melissa's past abuse was not allowed in by the trial judge. Can you talk a little bit about why the judge made that decision and why that may be an issue?
So there are complications with admission of experts. So first of all, a false confession, and again, we're using that shorthand term, expert, was not engaged to the level of the experts that the Innocence Project has brought on. And the judge has discretion when it comes to experts about whether to allow that expert to testify, and well, and anyone to testify. But for experts in particular, there is case law, there are evidentiary rules about whether an expert can testify. And the judge makes a determination about whether the testimony given by that person, by an expert, would be more prejudicial than probative. And that is a relevancy determination. And if the judge decides that this expert or this person does not have enough personal knowledge or expertise in a particular field, then the judge does not have to allow that person or that expert to testify. And there just wasn't any testimony to contradict the medical examiner there, but that's in the guilt innocence. But in the mitigation part, which is the, so I'm going to assume, but I'll just state real briefly that the trials in the criminal justice system in Texas are two parts. So there's the guilt, innocence part, and then there's the punishment part. And obviously you don't have punishment if the person is acquitted, but Melissa was found guilty by the jury based on her statement to law enforcement, from law enforcement judgment that Melissa didn't have the proper emotions when they brought her in, that she didn't grieve, that they believed that from her appearance, her facial expressions and the way she behaved, she was not grieving. And so that, along with the medical examiner's report that Mariah's injuries were caused by abuse, the jury found her guilty. So then the case proceeded to punishment. And the jury is responsible for that punishment determination. And they found that there weren't enough mitigating circumstances to find that she wasn't a danger to society and she didn't deserve the death penalty. So there should have been more mitigation evidence, but the mitigation specialist and expert that the attorney used at the time of the punishment trial, the mitigation specialist was not able to finish her reports and her investigation in time for the mitigation or the punishment part of the trial. So because of this, they didn't learn about Melissa's history of abuse. And that would have been something that the jury could have taken into consideration when determining whether or not Melissa should receive the death penalty. And you may be asking why it didn't come in during guilt innocence. And that's because it's not always relevant to the elements of the crime. So mitigation is primarily put in at the punishment stage. And the attorney for Melissa did not have time to complete the mitigation investigation that a specialist was hired to do. And the expert also was not able to give the complete story of Melissa's abuse. And that was because the judge has the discretion to allow that testimony or not to allow it. And this judge decided that her abuse wasn't relevant. It didn't explain why she had killed her daughter.
We'll come back to a couple of those things in a little bit, because you threw in some information about the defense attorney and some other things that I want to talk about. But before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about tunnel vision. So one of the things that comes up in most wrongful convictions is that law enforcement or the prosecutor or both ended up with tunnel vision in some way. They decided that this person made the most sense for the crime, and that's the direction that they went in, and that's the direction that they stayed with. So how, in this particular case, do you think tunnel vision played out?
Tunnel vision on any of the stakeholders in the criminal justice system is, it hurts the case for justice being done. Wrongful convictions happen when the defense attorney, the prosecutor, as you said, or the judge focuses in on one target, one person, or one aspect of the case that they believe shows guilt. And in Melissa Lucio's case, the law enforcement, that would be the first place where tunnel vision was a real problem. The law enforcement waited only 2 hours before deciding that Melissa Lucio was the perpetrator of Mariah's death. So 2 hours, and law enforcement, they know for sure in their minds that Melissa has done this, and they conduct their interrogation with that in mind. And they interrogate her for 5 hours because they believe she should confess, that she's the only one that could have done it. And she did it with the intention of hurting and killing Mariah. So they had to aggressively pursue Melissa. The father of Mariah, or rather Melissa's husband at the time, Robert, he was not focused on as the perpetrator of Mariah's death. He was charged with endangerment of a child and not really considered by law enforcement, despite his long history of domestic violence. Then Melissa proceeds to the trial phase or the charge phase, and prosecutors don't ask law enforcement to look into anyone else, and they focus their prosecution solely on Melissa. And I want to mention here that the prosecution also has discretion. The prosecution has a duty under the Criminal Code of Procedure, that's statutory law, that they have a duty to do justice. Defense attorneys don't have this, law enforcement don't have this duty, but it is written into our Code of Criminal Procedure that prosecutors, their job is to do justice. And when you focus in on only one person or one issue that you believe is guilty or shows guilt, then you may not be doing justice. You may not be giving the person who died, the victim, justice. And that's a big problem. So the prosecution focused on Melissa. They only sought out evidence that would support their case and confirmation bias. Maybe a lot of listeners have heard about confirmation bias. So you may overlook, even though you've got the evidence in front of you, you may overlook evidence that shows that someone else did this or that it wasn't an intentional act, but it was an accident, as it was in Melissa's case. Then, you know, the prosecutor is focusing on this. Sometimes the defense attorney will focus on only one issue and neglect some other area that would be helpful for their client at trial. And this is, we may talk about later, ineffective assistance of counsel. And one way that the courts have consistently found to be ineffective assistance of counsel is not to put on mitigation evidence. So there did seem to be some sort of shortcoming on the defense counsel's part of presenting that mitigation evidence. If you don't start to investigate mitigation, pretty much when you get the client, when you take on representation, then you may find yourself running out of time. And it's a life or death issue with a capital case. And so we're all subject to mistakes, but mitigation, especially more than anything, has to be put on at the punishment phase of a capital case. So the defense attorney may or may not, we haven't really gone into detail, and I haven't looked up those particular details about how much defense counsel may have focused on one thing and then neglected some other aspect, but prosecutors should only be bringing legitimate cases. The defense is really just trying to gather all the information, possibly doing their own investigation. It's a lot of work, and I would never without knowing all the details say that a prosecutor committed misconduct or defense attorney failed to do part of their job. But there are issues of tunnel vision with defense attorneys too. The judge in this case didn't allow the defense attorney to present mitigation evidence, particularly the domestic abuse, the sexual abuse that Melissa had suffered. And that may have also been caused by tunnel vision. Maybe the judge had decided that this person is guilty and should be put to death. So if a judge has that in their mind, then it may color how they instruct the jury, how they answer jury questions from the jury when they're deliberating, and whether they allow certain evidence to come in at trial. I have no knowledge of this judge's thinking at the time, but you ask me how tunnel vision can affect a wrongful conviction, and that might explain one way that wrongful convictions can happen when judges, defense attorneys, prosecutors, and law enforcement just have tunnel vision and focus on one person.
So you've mentioned Melissa's partner, Mariah's father, several times, and that his sentence was different. He was very low. He was charged with something completely different. Do you think that gender played a role in this case?
Yes. And I think people don't look at gender as something that might be a cause of a wrongful conviction. And I'm glad that you highlighted it, because gender plays into in a couple of ways. For example, Melissa, during her interrogation, was criticized for her parenting skills. A lot of people still have the view that mothers are the primary caretakers, and they have their own ideas of and expectations of what a quote-unquote good mother would do. And, you know, Melissa had 12 children and was pregnant with twins, and possibly because of her gender, her status as a Latina, and her poverty, people, law enforcement may have said that she wasn't a good parent because she had so many children. And how could she take care of that many children? And if she were a better parent, better mother in particular, she wouldn't have left Mariah unattended in such a way that she would fall, and she wouldn't have failed to take Mariah to the hospital immediately. But then again, I mean, Mariah didn't show any outward life-threatening symptoms. So healthcare is very expensive, and the cost for Melissa as a mother who's living in poverty, taking her child to the emergency room, is a factor. And it may cause someone to second guess, you know, is this something I need to do? And, you know, Melissa was terribly, terribly grieved when she found Mariah that wouldn't wake up, was dead on her on the bed. But people think it's, oh, she's a bad mother. If she had paid more attention, if she had gotten Mariah to the hospital sooner, then this wouldn't have happened. Mariah wouldn't have died. And so Melissa, being the mother, I think because of society's expectations of women as caretakers and mothers, that mothers just know they should know that their child is in danger, and the mother is more responsible than a father. And it's still amazing to me that Melissa's partner was found to be less culpable than Melissa. You know, Robert Alvarez, who was Mariah's father, he had a history of domestic violence, and yet he wasn't looked at seriously, and he certainly wasn't charged with Mariah's murder. And so the cultural expectations of a female, of a woman, of a mother, are so much higher than they are for men. And the majority of wrongful convictions for women, they're crimes of absence. There is no crime committed. Melissa's is a good example of no crime. And this was a tragic accident. And there is no other perpetrator that, you know, we can find DNA from this person and exonerate a woman wrongfully convicted. It's an accident. And so the jury is often looking at gender expectations for women that they might not otherwise look at. You know, even accidents are somehow the mother's fault. And another factor is intimidation, especially with someone who has a history of being abused. During the interrogation, the police were male. They were aggressive. They really emulated a lot of the conduct that her former abusers had when they were raping or physically abusing her in some way. And that causes post-traumatic stress, and it's a trigger. And women can often, you know, fight or flight reaction. And for women, they especially may find that shutting down, just taking whatever abuse is meted out by their partners is the only way to survive it, because fighting can result in their own death. So in wrongful convictions, being a woman is particularly salient because women are the majority of victims of domestic violence, which makes them susceptible to police intimidation. Women are expected to be these perfect mothers, and everyone seems to have an opinion on what a good mother would do. I think gender in particular is a good thing to consider when we're talking about wrongful convictions, especially in the case of women.
So we've talked a little bit about ineffective assistance of counsel already. And you and I have talked in the past that that's one of those things that comes up in almost every wrongful conviction case. They throw out ineffective assistance of counsel when they're throwing out all of their other causes. And that, you know, the bar can be pretty high for ineffective assistance of counsel to actually go anywhere. You talked about mitigation, but I've read that there were some other issues with the defense counsel, or at least things that cast the light that there might be issues with the defense counsel. And one of them was the fact that not long after this case, the defense counsel actually went into the prosecutor's office.
It's just like with jailhouse snitches or any witness, really, when there are incentives to testify a certain way, or in the case that you mentioned, you know, for a defense attorney not to get on the bad side of a district attorney's office that person is applying to, those are benefits that the jury should be made aware of when they're evaluating credibility. Or with ineffective assistance of counsel, is an important thing to be considered by the appellate court when deciding whether the defense attorney was ineffective. Because as I mentioned, no one likes to accuse another lawyer of acting in a malicious way or being lazy, but sometimes, and maybe it's subconscious, there are things that lead to bias. And certainly going on to work at the district attorney's office would in some way contribute to a bias on the defense attorney's side.
And on the district attorney's, on that topic, you mentioned at the beginning that the district attorney from that case is now in an interesting place, federal prison.
federal prison is certainly an interesting place. So the Cameron County elected district attorney, Villalobos, he personally oversaw Melissa's trial. He was very involved in her prosecution. And one instance of his corruption that I know of is that in 2007, he took a bribe and he allowed a man who had killed his estranged girlfriend, and he allowed that person to be released and escape. So this person who killed his former girlfriend was basically set free by then Cameron County District Attorney Villalobos, which allowed this person to escape. And he was never brought to trial, at least not by District Attorney Villalobos. And it's interesting the contrast between that case and Melissa's. So both Both cases had a death, but one was male and he was a known domestic abuser, but he was released in exchange for a bribe, whereas Melissa was female and the victim of domestic abuse. Former District Attorney Villalobos is now serving, I think, a 13-year federal sentence for bribery and extortion. So, interesting situation for sure.
Another interesting thing about this case was the testimony of, I believe it was the medical examiner. I think that she said that when she examined Mariah's body, that it was the worst case of child abuse that she had seen in her history in the position. And now other experts in this field are saying that it was actually a different type of injury or condition that caused it to look like Mariah had these bruises all over her body. How do you think that that testimony played into Melissa's conviction and sentencing? And how do you think that the new testimony from experts comes into play now in her new case that she's working on?
Dr. Farley was the medical examiner in Mariah's case. So Dr. Farley received Mariah's body, and during Dr. Farley's examination of Mariah, law enforcement was present and they told Dr. Farley their opinion that Melissa had abused Mariah, and that led to Dr. Farley's conclusion that Mariah's injuries could have only been caused by abuse. And Dr. Farley stated this unambiguously. And so that's another example of how law enforcement influenced this investigation. But going back to the autopsy and medical examination, that there can be multiple causes for an injury, bruising being one example. I can get a bruise if I hit my elbow into a door or something. But I can also be more susceptible to bruises, even though I don't really injure myself seriously because of a medical condition that I suffer. So I think what Dr. Farley did in this case was to land on one conclusion for the cause of those injuries, when really the jury should have been presented with all of the possible causes of those injuries. And again, I'm going to say it's probably the reason why Dr. Farley made those conclusions was law enforcement telling Dr. Farley it was because the mother abused Mariah and because they believed that they had the case solved. So when Dr. Farley testified, then the jury only had the testimony of this medical examiner, and the medical examiner was unambiguous in the conclusion stated for those injuries. And so the jury was left with no other alternative. And that should have been presented to the jury. And in fact, the former jurors, the five jurors that were interviewed for the writ of habeas and the clemency application for Melissa Lucio, stated that if they had had that additional evidence, they would have come to a different conclusion, but they didn't have the option of other possible causes for Mariah's injuries.
So what is it that you would like the public to know about this case? Or do you have a perception of this case that you think people have that could maybe be corrected? You know, what would you want to wrap up with? What would you want to leave people with when it comes to the Melissa Lucio case?
I'd like to highlight again the gender bias here and the fact that the wrongfully convicted women, historically, it's been a no crime conviction. And a lot of times, a lot of those cases are injuries or death to children. I think we can all understand wanting to find whoever is the cause of injury to children. But in that zeal to protect our vulnerable populations, the children, there can be a rush to judgment. And Melissa Lucio's case is a prime example of that, that because this was an injury or a death of a child, that rush to judgment was crucial in leading to a wrongful conviction in Melissa's case. And the Innocence Project and the Innocence Project of Texas are working to right those wrongs, but there are a lot of cases. Texas incarcerates, it has some of the highest rates of incarceration in the country. And the United States has, I think it's maybe number two, number one of incarcerated citizens. I mean, the incarceration rate is huge. So finding the wrongful conviction cases and correcting those wrongs is a huge task. And so the Innocence Project would like to get the message out to people, stakeholders in the system, law enforcement, prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, that rushes to judgment are a big cause of wrongful convictions. And that if we took a little bit more time at the trial level to investigate and make sure that we're not charging first and investigating later, then we wouldn't have as many wrongful convictions, and we wouldn't have vulnerable people like Melissa Lucio sitting in prison and being sentenced to death for an accident, a tragic accident that people didn't take the time to look into adequately. They saw a mother with 12 children and poverty, and they decided she wasn't a good parent and she was the cause of her daughter's death. And rushes to judgment, tunnel vision, we need to all take a step back and look at how those play a big factor in wrongful conviction.
And how can people learn more about Melissa's case?
The Innocence Project and the Innocence Project of Texas, you can go to their website, and they have summaries of what's going on in the cases. I believe there are also newsletters or email newsletters that you can subscribe to, and they give updates on all the cases the Innocence Project and the Innocence Project of Texas are working on, but they will keep people up to date on what's going on in Melissa Lucio's case in particular. And hopefully more people will start to take an interest in wrongful convictions and how they hurt our communities. Wrongful convictions are the seed of distrust in our judicial system. When you realize that wrongful convictions happen and people are put to death, like Cameron Todd Willingham, executed and then found later to be innocent of the arson he was accused of that killed two boys. And those wrongful convictions lead the community to believe that justice in our country, in our state, in our communities is arbitrary and capricious. And you don't know if you're going to get justice in the system. So wrongful convictions should spur more people to get involved politically, research those judges that are on the ballot. Research how you can lobby your legislators to pass laws that will help protect the accused when on trial. And that, for example, writs of habeas corpus, you're not entitled to appointed counsel. That can be changed. We can change our laws so that people who are filing writs of habeas do get counsel, and people who are actually innocent have a better shot of getting justice when they weren't afforded justice at the trial court.
Naomi, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. It was a great conversation. For those of you who are interested in learning more about the individual causes of wrongful convictions and the history of the actual innocence movement, I encourage you to check out the Center for American and International Law's YouTube channel. We have a playlist specifically on causes of wrongful convictions and actual innocence topics. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been the Partners in Justice podcast, and I'm Vicki Adams.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Partners in Justice. The Center for American and International Law, founded in 1947, is a Dallas-based nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the quality of justice through the education of tens of thousands of lawyers and law enforcement officials in the United States and throughout the world. Ultimately, our success depends on the leadership and support of our members. We invite you and your organization to learn more about us. Make sure to visit our website, www.cailaw.org, where you can subscribe to the show and learn more about our programs, lectures, and upcoming events. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you simply shared this show with a friend, that would help us out too. Thanks again for listening to Partners in Justice.